Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Peter Lawrenson from the University of San Francisco. My guest today is Iza Ding, an assistant professor of political science at the University of Pittsburgh. Today, we're going to talk about her new book, The Performative State, Public Scrutiny and Environmental Governance in China. Iza, welcome.
Thank you, Peter. It's great to be here.
So, Iza, my stereotype of Chinese bureaucrats involves a lot of people kind of sitting around a really dreary office building, sipping tea, reading the newspaper, taking naps at their desk. So kind of a steady job, but not very hard and also not very fulfilling. But this is not what you saw in your field work, looking at the Environmental Protection Bureau in China. So tell me what it was like there.
It was indeed not like that. And what you described, the Chinese bureaucrat sitting at their desk, reading newspapers, drinking tea, and monitoring the stock market. Don't forget about the stock market. Is the image of the bureaucrat actually you will find in papers, articles, books on environmental governance in China a few decades ago. So for instance, in the 1990s, there's this general image of inertia with environmental governance. And there's also studies done on local corruption, for instance. But that's not the, what I observed when I was in China, following these environmental bureaucrats around. And what I saw was what I call performative governance. And first, I expected to see a bunch of people who were just very inactive. But what I saw was hyperactivity of the bureaucracy. So these bureaucrats were constantly on the move. But what's so interesting is that they're super active, but they're not doing much that were effectively that could effectively change the behavior of the enterprises. And performative governance is what they did instead. And this is, I define this as the state's deployment of verbal, visual, and gestural symbols of good governance for the audience of citizens. So what they were doing is that they were enacting these symbols of good governance. And the idea is that states, in this case, China's environmental state, use this to diffuse public opinion crises and to shape public perceptions of itself. And the main alternative to performative governance is substantive governance, meaning governance that is geared toward giving people what they demand and what they deserve.
So to make it concrete in the context of environmental government, the substantive would be like, I'm shutting down factories, or I'm levying punitive fines on people who are polluting too much, or forcing them to install, scrubbers or something like that. But you're saying that wasn't what they were doing. So what were they riding around all day keeping busy doing instead?
So there were fines, but the fines were so small that the enterprises were happy to pay those periodic fines, then to upgrade their pollution treatment facilities or to run the scrubbers all the time, because electricity is expensive. So the fines would be a slap on the wrist. The environmental bureaucracy couldn't close down factory. It didn't even have the legal authority to close down factories. But what they were busy doing mostly was kind of running around doing these investigations, and also in the process, in their interactions with the citizens, demonstrating a lot of responsiveness to citizen demands, and also benevolence, or what the government itself calls service-orientedness. So some examples of service-orientedness would be, for example, you're a citizen, you're upset about a factory in your neighborhood, and then you go to the EPA, the Chinese EPA, to file a complaint, or you call them up on the environmental hotline to launch a complaint. And then what the bureaucrats do is that they're fully aware they're not able to resolve your complaints. But what they do is that they stay on the phone, they act as your punching bags, they play therapist, and if you're in the office, they serve you tea. They're being very, very nice to you. And then they're also very responsive to citizen complaints, but remain symbolically responsive because the investigations, most of them result in non-punishment of the enterprises, and the bureaucrats are fully aware of that.
But they sort of fool the people. Like, people come in and hear someone and they say, well, we're going to address your concerns, and then they just kind of go away and give up and assume something's going to happen.
So they don't completely fool people. And this is what's really interesting here. And I can just tell you, there is this media training guide I came across during field work. And actually, most of the bureaucrats, they receive media training. And then, so in the training guide, bureaucrats are taught to increase their contacts with journalists. So when there are these environmental crises happening in the localities, usually, citizens will complain, and then journalists will reach out. So then what these bureaucrats were told is that when you're talking to the journalists and when you're kind of trying to, you know, explain to them what's happening and help them make sense of the environmental issues, you explain to them, you faithfully explain to them the process, right? You tell them the facts, but then you avoid speaking about results. So they're not completely lying to you, right? They know they're ineffective, but they're not lying to you. In fact, in some of the responses to citizen complaints, they actually tell you that, we did all these investigations and we didn't discover any violations of environmental regulations and policies. And thank you very much for supporting our environmental governance. So it's not lying, but they emphasize certain things over others. They will emphasize how hard the bureaucracy was working on addressing citizen complaints. They'll emphasize, we stayed up all night to catch the polluters. We braved the snow to catch the polluters. We outsmart them. And then we know that they started running their scrubbers during the day, so we stayed up till 2 a.m. and then we surprised attacked them, right? So these efforts of, these efforts and gestures and kind of these symbols of concern for citizens' issues, and also kind of reaching out to them, asking them to give their inputs about the investigation process. And these things are emphasized over others. And the things that get de-emphasized is the result, is that at the end of the day, that very few enterprises get punished. And those that get punished are, they're punished over and over again. So so some of the enterprises that were given fines during my field work, I actually made sure to check the EPB's website the 12 months later, and the following year, then the following year. So even 2019, the same enterprises were still receiving citizen complaints on the EPB's website. So then I could know for sure that these investigations have had a very small impact on enterprise behavior. And the bureaucrats, to be sure, they know that, they knew that, and they, you know, and I know they know that because they tell me that, they told me that. But they still felt it was really important to respond to the citizens and to express their concern and their care, and also sometimes to get into the news cycle, get in the middle of the news cycle, and then to be actively shaping the bureaucracy's public image in the public sphere.
Okay, so for people who don't know China as well, I think there's a few things about context we should probably go over. So first of all, I didn't specify it at the beginning, but your fieldworks was from basically 2013 was when it was, you started out, and then you kind of continued through 2018, 2019. Is that right? Just to fix
the
time frame.
I did participation in 2013 and 14. And then in the years after that and before, you know, until before COVID, I was doing follow-up interviews.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's pretty much a picture of the mid 2010s. So the background, so one thing, is, you know, China has certainly, bureaucratically kind of promoted the level of the Environmental Protection Bureau, over time, and in the bureaucratic structure, and also has placed more and more, you know, pretty much a continually rising emphasis on, you know, how serious they are about the environment. So, you know, the 1990s picture where, you know, if they even, you know, they pretend to have an environmental, you know, bureaucracy, but at most it would just collect funds, you know, collect some fees, which would help fund it. And then, but nothing would actually happen. But now they claim to be taking it seriously. So why does the EPB not have any power to actually make anything happen?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there are kind of two ways of, answering this question. So the one thing is the subjects of my study, I was observing these street level bureaucrats. So there is a gap between what the bureaucrats do at the street level and what they do in Beijing. And obviously we can say, you know, we can talk about whether these people in Beijing, we're still calling them, you know, bureaucrats, or could some of those also be politicians. But anyway, so this book ultimately is a book about bureaucratic behavior at the street level. And a lot of those decisions, for instance, the closure of the factories and the coal mines, and then the closure of some of the coal fire plants, and actually some of those got reversed later. But those decisions come from above, and they come from Beijing. So what we're seeing is, on the one hand, you know, you could read it in the news about these dramatic closure of coal fire plants. But at the same time, there is this more invisible reality of everyday governance. And that's what I was looking at in my fieldwork. And my subjects, the street level bureaucrats, they had no power over those decisions. And then the other answer to your question is that the book also documents the evolution of the bureaucracy over time. So it started out from this place of inertia in the, as you mentioned, in the 1980s and 90s, where the bureaucracy had very few people, little resources, and they didn't do much. But then in the mid-2000s, I would say since the 2008 Beijing Summer Olympics and also after January 2013, when Beijing's airpocalypse made it into the New York Times, and all of a sudden you see this rising public scrutiny over environmental issues and air pollution, water pollution. But at the time, the bureaucracy still lacked the capacity to address a lot of those issues. Then what they could do, and one of the only things they could do, was to get out, to appear, you know, appear responsive and benevolent to the citizens in order to shelter themselves from blame. And then in recent years, as you mentioned, especially since the super ministries reform in the around 2018, you see the bureaucracy gaining more capacity. And I wouldn't say they are a strong bureaucracy now. I still don't think it's a strong, it's anywhere near a strong bureaucracy. But you definitely see more both kind of legal authority, but also just political clout and resources that's been given to the EPB or the EPA in China. And then you do see that their behavior, their governance has started to tend toward the substantive. So my theory is sort of this, there are kind of two dimensions and two factors I'm looking at. One is bureaucratic capacity, and then the other is public scrutiny. And the argument is that in the mid-2000s and in the, especially around 2013, bureaucratic capacity was low, but public scrutiny was high. And this is a pair of conditions under which we see performative governance, but it's not a static theory in that if the conditions change, we're likely to see a change of bureaucratic behavior.
Right. So it's not a kind of entrenched equilibrium. If the external conditions change, it will change in response to that. And so you think it is, so it changed from having no power and also no public or bureaucratic pressures. So that was kind of the 90s where this, all they cared about was, grow. And if people were polluted and, their crops were failing or whatever, it wasn't really a problem as long as the GDP numbers looked good. And then you're saying starting 2010s, especially, then there started to be pressure to at least look like you're doing something, but they weren't actually being given the authority to really make anything happen. But you think in recent years, they've actually got enough power that they are at least able to do a little bit more substantive?
Yeah.
Great. Well, so then the other thing, this is more, backstory for people who don't know China as well, but why in an authoritarian state are they worried about, their pressure from below or grandma showing up and shaking her fist about the pollution at all?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. I think different scholars would give you different answers. And I think my view, and I think it also, and let me just start out by saying that the CCP is a revolutionary regime. So it came to power through a mass revolution. So in a way, it came to power through public opinion. And it knows from the very beginning that public opinion is a very, very powerful thing. And if you just look at the writings and speeches of the communist leaders since day one, they really think this is something that could change regimes. And this is why they care. And then there's also this political culture argument saying that in China, there is this, history of using the petition system to gather information and then to let citizen, because you're in a big country, kind of tell the center what their dissatisfactions are, and then for the centers to come in and resolve these local issues. So there's that view as well. And I think what I'm also exploring in this book is that given these underlying conditions, given this larger phenomenon of this revolutionary regime that really attends to public opinion, then what are the conditions under which we're going to see different types of state behavior? And then there is my argument of these two things that we could pay attention to, which is capacity and scrutiny. But kind of to answer your larger question, I think my own theory would be that it's got a lot to do with the social revolution, the regime into power.
And I guess just to root it in, what specifically you had the opportunity to see from your participant observation, the fear of these bureaucrats, it's not that they could get directly, they're not elected, so they're not worried about the citizens coming in and, pushing them out, but they have bosses at higher levels of the city or municipal government who will care if there's an outbreak of bad news, and then might fire them or punish them in some way?
Yes. They, you know, it's capricious in terms of you can't predict what are the conditions under which people get fired, but they do get fired. But there is a recent institution I thought was really interesting. I saw a few weeks ago in Beijing. There's this new rule. I don't know if it's a district or the entire city, saying that if you get 2 complaints from citizens over the period of a year, you can get your annual bonuses cut. So that's why they have to be nice to people, because if they're not, people, you know, file a complaint about a bureaucrat, then they can end up with less money or no job at the end of the year.
Right. So very direct incentives for them. Yeah. I guess on the big picture, I'd also, I think what you say about the communist, revolutionary legacy is part of it, although it also links with Sergei Guriev and Dan Treisman's arguments they've been making that, all modern dictatorships are kind of facing pressures to move in this direction, with the expansion of information technology and people know more about what's going on. So you can't just kind of boss them around and repress them. You do that too, but like you also need to at least maintain some appearance of legitimacy, which comes from a mix of, actual performance. You talk a lot about the double meaning of performance, right? So actual achievements, or delivering on your the things that people want, but also performance and propaganda, and convincing them that you're doing what they want.
Absolutely. And I actually this reminds me of a book I recently read. So it's called Kings and Judges by Deborah Bukuyanis. Actually, the book is about Europe. But in the book, she mentioned these petitions, the petitioning system kind of in medieval Europe, which starts to make me, question to what extent is this unique to China. It seems like there's a petition system in every country historically. So that's something that I would be curious to learn more about.
Maybe we should. I know, I think I actually first met you along with Martin Dimitrov, who's our king of petition systems. So
yes.
Should get him should on his next him. Book, yeah. Doing the historical yeah. survey.
Yeah, it's a great book on information and dictatorship.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to talking with him about that on this show soon as well. All right. So we talked briefly about like whether people believe that any of this has any effect, and you did some additional research to sort of get into that with a survey and with the study of newspapers. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that, how you tested this idea of like, how much do people really believe this in this performative actions?
Sure. It's a really important question. Do people fall for this? And the answer is sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. So I use this survey and use in-depth interviews to kind of figure out, first is, does this work at the aggregate level? Because the pivotal audience of performative governance is not the individuals who are complaining, because based on my survey, only a very small fraction of the entire population in China, but also elsewhere, has ever complained to the government because people are busy. So the larger audience, so this, the pivotal audience of performative governance is obviously the larger citizenry, and then it reaches this larger audience through the news media. So what I did in this chapter four is to, I did this survey in 30 cities covering over 6,000 citizens, and then to ask them questions about their satisfaction with local environmental governance and other questions as well. And what I did is I then collected media reports from the local daily newspaper and counted the number of news reporting that contain the key components of performative governance over the 12-month period prior to the survey. And then I ran some models, and what I found is that there's no, you know, this is not causality. I don't need to explain that. But in general, there's this positive relationship between the intensity of performative governance in the news and citizen satisfaction in a given city. And then I did some interviews to figure out, okay, why are some people convinced by this? Why are some people are not convinced by this? And in general, you see kind of two types of citizens to the extent that they buy this. So the first type of citizens are those who are living farther away from the pollution sources. So by watching the news, they believe that the government has been doing things, so the, you know, air quality is in the process of improving. And then there's the other type of citizen who are fully aware that air quality is bad, or they perhaps even think that economic development is more important than environmental protection, or they, you know, support this view. But then they still give the government credit for trying in that, you know, this term of the street level bureaucrats displaying good attitude is something that came up during my interviews. And then the other thing I found, what I think is the more interesting thing kind of out of the survey analysis, is that people in the survey, I had questions that gauge people's propensity to use the petition system or to use protest to air their grievances. And what I found is that people who are more satisfied with local environmental governance, people who give higher approval rating scores to the local government, when they have a problem, the likelihood that they are going to use petition system is positive. So you're 11% more likely to use the petition system if you're more satisfied with the local government, but you're less likely to use protest. Whereas for people who are not satisfied, they're more likely to use protest instead of petition. So this kind of indirectly lends evidence to this argument or this logic that performative governance is about ameliorating these smaller scale grievances before they amalgamate into some kind of large scale public opinion crisis. So I thought that finding is also very interesting.
Right. And you could sort of see, yeah, the kind of the causality of that story can go either way. But yeah, that like, if you have a basic confidence that this government works, then, you know, go ahead and when something goes wrong, it's like, oh, well, they'll fix it for me. You know, it's not a problem. As opposed to if you've given up hope and you think they are all just sipping tea or
exactly
putting on a show, then you feel like you have to like get out there and do something risky, like agitate in the streets and make a big nuisance before something will happen.
Yeah. And I think this is also what Martin's book found, or at least one of his findings or one of his arguments, is that people use the system when they have trust in the system. So this is finding from Eastern Europe, from China, is that the people actually use the petition system when they have high trust in the government. They stop using that when they when their trust in the government starts to decline.
Yeah, exactly. If people stop coming to me with problems, then that's when I should get ready for the revolution.
You should get worried. Yeah.
So this it sounds like it, you know, worked for its, well, I guess for at least, you know, the environmental folks could get by on this system, and then maybe it's actually they're getting a little bit more oomph behind their enforcement capabilities. So do you feel, to be more speculative, do you feel optimistic about China's environmental quality and enforcement continuing to improve in the future?
That is a really important question. It's a hard question to answer. My general answer will be yes. And I think that's the direction in which hopefully we're collectively moving, and hopefully all countries are moving. And I think we are going to see short-term ups and downs. And this is always what we've seen. So in my one of my papers with your student, Denise Vanderkemp, one of our cases is this coal to gas policy from 2017. For a bunch of northern cities to switch from coal burning to use gas stoves. But then because gas was expensive, people couldn't afford it. And then you started to see in the news that people, school children are freezing and things like that. And they immediately reversed the policy and told people to go back to coal burning. So there's always going to be ups and downs. But I think what's really interesting, and I've been thinking about this, is that now because a big part of emissions, both carbon emissions and pollution, comes from consumption and doesn't just come from manufacturing itself. So since we're likely to see a period of slowing economic growth, and if the economy doesn't improve as fast as the government would like for it to do, then we're likely to see less consumption, and then that ironically helps with the environmental problem. So one of my crazy predictions is that if the economy slows down in China, then it became cheaper to use the political science term for the government to increase environmental propaganda and kind of explain economic slowdown through the environmental frame and through this idea that we're serious about climate change and so on and so forth. And I think they are, but I think what we're going to see in the environmental sphere will also depend on what we see, what happens with the economy. But I think at the leadership level, there's certainly interest in not just cleaning up the environment, but also taking a leadership role in this global effort to mitigate climate change.
Right. Yeah, I could see it kind of going either way, I suppose, because economic slowdowns, do in the short run reduce economic output, but longer run, I think there's generally, better environment is kind of a luxury good, relatively speaking. And so, as you said, in this instance, if you think, oh, well, we should switch to gas from coal, but then you realize, the kids are freezing, then the pressure is, flipped very, very quickly. It's like, okay, well, we've got to keep the people at least basically warm in the winter, and we'll have to put off the other stuff till later. But you're right that there is also this element where the fact which probably was inevitable that, China's growth was not going to continue at the same pace that it had, kind of gives them a little bit of cover to say that they shouldn't really be blamed for all of the slowdown anyway, because that's just what happens to countries as they develop more. But saying that they're, re-emphasizing environment also gives them a little bit of cover for that. So in your, you also have a chapter on performative breakdown, which looks at some other cases. Why don't you give us a quick overview of what you looked at there?
Sure. So in that chapter, I'm looking at the conditions under which performative governance stops working. And one of the ways it stops working is when it stops convincing people of the state's virtue. So I'm looking at some cases outside of China. So I can just give you the pair of most different case comparisons at the in the second part of the chapter, where I look at where I compare the Flint water crisis and the Wuhan government's management of the pandemic in its early stages. So in both cases, despite China being a autocracy and America being a democracy, despite these regime differences, both of these local governments engaged in performative governance. So in Flint, we had the mayor and the governor getting on TV, drinking water in front of the camera. And then in Wuhan, we had similar things, and also this, you know, performative rescue in the night of the passing of Dr. Li Wenliang. So eventually it did not work in convincing the public, in part because those are quite large-scale crises. But also it was when these destructive information about state behavior got released into the public by, in both cases, whistleblowers, did the public become wider, become aware of those crises. And in those situations, performative governance simply does not work. So my belief is that the information environment is very important. But even as we know, the information, you know, there's more censorship in authoritarian regimes and there's freedom of speech in democracies. But at the end of the day, in authoritarian regimes, you could still have these pockets of the state's lack of control over its information environment, and then for those destructive information to reach the citizenry. And even in democracies, you could see that, you know, you could have the free flow of information, but sometimes these information just does not reach the citizens.
Right, I guess, and I would say also, you know, in democracies, there seems to be sometimes that the sometimes a performative governance kind of in response to information. So, you know, there's a mob gets excited online about some issue, maybe in an uninformed or unbalanced way, and then puts pressure on the government to do something, and so they do something just to appear to be doing something, rather than doing something in the most effective way, or in a way that takes into account sort of, you know, all the complicated trade-offs that they may have to face, which is, you know, probably still better than being completely unaccountable, but often like leads to weird examples. Actually, just a link to the, so oddly enough, the, a China paper, a China book and an AI book both talk about Flint, Michigan, which I guess, cause we're in America, so we all know about it, but the AI book, has an interesting story, and it's Avi Goldfarb and his co-authors, who I just interviewed him last week. We didn't cover this story in the interview, but it struck me that so anyway, in Flint, Michigan, apparently they developed an AI algorithm of some kind that was quite good at determining which pipes were likely to have lead in them. It was like 80% accurate or something, and initially they were using that, but the problem is then it led to sometimes your neighbor's house would get its pipes replaced, but yours wouldn't. Or sometimes the poorer neighborhoods would get their pipes replaced before a richer neighborhood. And then the rich people would be like, hey, wait a minute. And they would, you know, I'm terrified of lead and I am highly mobile and I'm a donor. So they mobilized and they convinced the mayor to abandon the rational system and to go house by house, just like working through the city in a way that tended to, you know, that was much less effective. So when they used that system, maybe 20% of the pipes actually needed to be replaced. And this takes time. So it takes months to go through this and like dig up all these pipes. But that felt fairer to people. And so the pressure was actually to do something that looked fair, but was less effective. But then apparently there was a lawsuit that then brought by someone who then said, look, you're digging up pipes for no reason, and you're actually harming the people who have the leaded pipes by taking so long to get to them, because you have to like go to the other, you know, all the neighborhoods in order. And so this was brought back in. Anyway, just an example of
so interesting
a kind of perverse performativity, you know, where, I mean, they were at least doing something about the lead pipes, and they would have gotten to them eventually, but, you know, another year or two of lead exposure for a child is obviously still very significant. And if they were doing it in the less effective sequence, because of, in this case, because of public pressure.
Yeah, this reminds me of my field work. So what I saw in my field work is that I counted every business, how every business hour was spent. And then at the end, I looked at this, and about 70% of their business hours were devoted during those 5 months were devoted to addressing citizen complaints, smaller or larger scale inspections. And what's interesting is that oftentimes those inspections diverted resources and manpower from these planned out regular inspections. So this kind of rational bureaucracy has a plan at the beginning of the year, month, season on, okay, how do we kind of select enterprises to, you know, who to investigate, who to inspect, and then what are some of the key point enterprises, what are some of the sectors we're targeting this season, and things like that. So if we believe that that's the most rational, efficient way of improving the local environment, then one could make a similar observation as what they did in Flint, Michigan. Obviously, in this case, it's not the rich people who are complaining. The people living close to these industrial zones are obviously not the richest in China, but it's kind of, you know, that going to places where that generates the most complaints. And you could see in a way, I mean, theoretically, if it's possible, you would sort of compare these two models of governance and see which one leads to more air pollution reduction. And I think if the AI argument in Flint applies here, then you would see actually if they just follow their original plan, you could actually achieve more reduction in emissions or in pollution at the end of the year.
Yeah, these things seem to be, they have a lot in common, right? There's this common phenomenon of, you know, it's good to be responsive to public pressure versus, you know, sitting and sipping tea. But if the public pressure is a little bit random in terms of, you know, what's certain groups are more noisy or certain groups are more, you know, have the time to go bang on the door of the relevant administrators or have more political leverage, then that can skew things off what, you know, might be the bureaucratic optimum. Although, of course, you know, both in the China and the US, we don't necessarily have confidence that our governments are just doing the right thing when we don't complain either. So it's a tricky balance. Why don't we just, as a last thing, can you tell me what your next book project is about? What's happening for you?
Oh, I'm working on this book project that's looking at this phenomenon of environmental nationalism. So when we usually think about environmentalism in the political science discipline, we think about this as a post-material value, mm-hmm. a liberal modern post-material value. But the book looks at the conditions under which environmentalism fuses with other anti-modern values, such as nationalism, authoritarianism, and right-wing populism, and so forth. So that's my next book project.
Sounds fascinating. Okay, well, thank you so much for coming on the show to talk today, and definitely encourage listeners to get a copy of the book. It's The Performative State, Public Scrutiny and Environmental Governance in China, and it's available in all good bookstores near you.